Hey, y'all. Welcome to this week's episode of We Rebel.
Emily, I have a question for you. Do you have any family members that served in the military?
I do. I have a few.
You have a few.
I have a Navy SEAL.
Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. My dad served in the Marines, and I went to the Marine Corps Museum.
Amazing.
So that
How
was
it?
It was really cool. Actually, there was a split moment where I thought, I kind of want to join the Marines. It's a very, like, they do a great job of, you know, selling what the armed forces can do for you. And I think there's something about camaraderie and teamwork and something like that that speaks to a person, you know, and that's what makes it enticing.
And also, I feel like in any given situation in the armed forces, you develop that camaraderie under very intense circumstances. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of binding.
Which is interesting because this year we wanted to talk, you know, about some new topics, and women in the military, I think, is something that doesn't really get addressed as much.
It doesn't get addressed until there's a problem.
Exactly. Right. It's usually, you know, in some sort of negative context.
Even though,
about, yeah.
As we might learn in our interview, there's kind of issues that we got to work on all the time. It's not just when there's a headline. So
absolutely.
I really enjoyed talking to Lori, and I'm excited to have our listeners tune in.
Yes. Captain Lori Manning. She's fantastic. And if you're a history buff, you're going to learn a lot wonderful things in this interview.
You're going to want to go home and Google a whole lot more things after this one.
Yes, absolutely. So
she's the current director of government relations for the Service Women's Action Network. So stick around. Hey, everyone. I'm really excited to interview this week's guest. Her name is Lori Manning. She is a retired captain from the U.S. Navy and currently working as the Director of Government Relations for the Service Women's Action Network, which we'll likely shorthand call SWAN on this conversation. So welcome to the podcast, Lori.
Well, I'm really pleased to be here. These are things I always enjoy talking about.
Great. Well, I read your bio online, and I would say that 55% of what's in there, I could understand what you do and what you've done. And then the other less than half, 45%, I am confused. So I'd love to hear from you about what inspires you to join the Navy at the start. You know, what is the Naval Telecommunications Computer Station? You know, what was your life like in that era while you were serving?
Yeah, I served in an earlier era, and it was a time, I started out, the Vietnam War was still going, so, I had graduated from college, and I was looking for something to do that didn't involve teaching or typing.
Sure.
Which were kind of hard to find for young women in those days, and I stumbled upon a Navy recruiter in New York City, and she kept showing me pictures of herself, with this glamorous life in Hawaii. And I thought, well, I want to travel. There's only 2 years that I have to sign up for. And they'll teach me something besides how to teach or how to type or be somebody's executive assistant. And so I joined with the thought that I'd stay for 2 years, and ended up for more than 25 years. Mm-hmm. And as things would happen, the first duty station I had was Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
Wow.
As to naval telecommunications stations, the Army calls it Signal Corps, but what it involved is keeping up radio links, and as time went by and I stayed in longer, computer links to ships at sea, planes in the air, both U.S. and sometimes Australian or British or other allies, Canadians, and the shore, so that there was a way of communicating with them, also with submarines under the water, and also some stuff that you would consider cryptographic stuff, intelligence things. That's sort of what I did as my main jobs throughout my Navy career. They call it information warfare now. We called it telecommunications back then. And I also did a number of what they call the headquarters staff work in Washington, D.C., some of them in communications, But one of the jobs I had was as the congressional travel officer for all congressmen and women who were going to visit military bases or on diplomatic kinds of things overseas. And I learned a lot then about how the military and Congress work together and don't work together. And I also did some work in women officers' career patterns, which is when I became very interested in why on earth the military had permission, not only permission, but the law allowed them to discriminate against women in a way that no other profession could. This was as time went by in 70s, 80s, 90s, into the 2000s. Women, simply because they belonged to the class of women, were not allowed to do things in the Navy, and it became my mission to make that change, both while I was on active duty and later after I retired through some of the work I've done with SWAN and an earlier group called the Women's Research and Education Institute, which had one of the earliest feminist kinds of projects on women in the military and women veterans and the conditions that they worked under.
Yep. That's wonderful, because it's so inspiring to hear that, you know, on a whim, just someone showing just a simple picture was enough for you to say, like, hey, I'm curious about it, let me see. And then you've provided a lifetime almost of service to it's a call to action, really. And then we talk about that a lot on this podcast, like, what was your call to action, what inspired you to get involved? And so not only did you serve, but then you saw what was going on. There was, you know, why are there laws in place that allows people to discriminate? And so then I wonder, if my memory serves me correctly, it wasn't until 1976 that I think the first women were admitted to the U.S. Military Academy. So it was still pretty new at that time. So what was that like, integrating women into the armed forces like that? I can't imagine it was an easy transition. And so tell me about your experience with that.
Well, it's been a 100-year-long transition, believe it or not.
Wow.
It started in 1901 after the Spanish-American War, when there were very stereotypical considerations about men also that the Army had, that men made lousy nurses. And during the typhoid epidemics of the Spanish-American War, the Army went out and hired a lot of civilian women to serve as nurses, but decided things would go better if they were actually in the Army. So after the Spanish-American War in 1901, as part of the Army Reorganization Act of 1901, they convinced Congress to set up a female-only nursing corps for the Army, and Congress did the same for the Navy 8 years later, and 7 years later in 1908. And it was, as I said, it was because the sensibility was at that time men couldn't be caring and nurturing, that women is what you needed if you were sick. And then in World War I, there just weren't enough men to fill some jobs, so enlisted women were brought into the military for the first time, including the first African-American women to serve, doing clerical work and as the service telephone operators. As soon as the war was over, they were all kicked out and had to go home. And then during World War II, again for the same reason, we needed more people than there were men. And so we brought in over 400,000 women to serve during World War II in a very wide range of jobs, everything short of combat, really. Although there were a number of military nurses who were still all women at this time who were killed in action, so to speak. Six of them died on the beach at Anzio because they were part of the invasion team. They weren't able to shoot back, but they were certainly able to be shot. But after World War II, there was a big debate. Should we keep women in the active forces or send them all home again?
Wow.
And in 1948, Congress passed a law called the Women Armed Forces Integration Act, which allowed a small cadre of both enlisted women and women officers to remain on active duty in the peacetime regular forces. And this was revolutionary for the time. This was a really dramatic and unexpected thing to allow. But it was under very tight conditions. And it was because at that time, and of course, it looked like the Cold War was just starting and there was much fear that we'd be back at war sooner rather than later, and they wanted a cadre of women there to quickly bring more women back into service if the balloon went up again. But the conditions that they were allowed to serve under now would make your hair stand on end. They only 2% of the total active force was allowed to be female, and only 10% of those 2% could be officers. They were not allowed to be admirals or generals at all, and the colonels and captains was limited to two. Two in each service, one who was head of the nurse corps, one who was in charge of the rest of the women. But it was only temporary while they were in those jobs. If they needed longer to retire, they had to go back to lieutenant, colonel, or commanders. If a woman got pregnant, she was out. Or if she married a guy that came with a kid who was in the household more than 30 days of the year, she had to get out.
What? How did they even come up with that number? 30 days is the tipping point. What? That sounds ludicrous.
Yeah. It was seen as sort of the typical, the kid is home from school for the summer and somebody better be there with him or her.
And it better be the woman. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Even if it was somebody else, even though the child was not your child, or if you adopted a child, or if your parents died and you became the custodian of younger siblings.
Wow.
If you were a woman, you had to get out. If you were a male, you could just bring them into your household and continue supporting them. Other things, they wrote right into the law that women could not serve on Navy vessels except hospital ships or transport ships. And they wrote into the law that they could not serve in any kind of aircraft crew if there was a chance that that aircraft, and there was always a chance that any aircraft, could be involved in combat. So it kept them out of seagoing jobs and out of aircraft jobs. Interestingly enough, they never said anything about forbidding women in ground combat, because at that time it was seen as so outrageous that anybody would even think of letting women in combat, even though the Soviets had done it in World War II because they'd run out of men. They didn't bother to put that in the law. It also said women could not have what's called command authority over men. That is the ability to order them to a court-martial or to award them what they call non-judicial punishment for minor offenses, which meant women couldn't be in charge of any installations except like women's boot camp.
Oh, come on.
Well,
so that's where we started in 1948, and the history of the next 70 years has been those prohibitions falling away one at a time, either by service policy changes, by Congress changing the law, or by the Supreme Court rendering a decision. For instance, that law also said that if you could be married in 1948, but you weren't allowed to get benefits for your husband, and that's who you were married to in those days, unless he was dependent on you for 50% at least of his support, and not because he was jobless, but because he was disabled in some way. And that was finally done away with in a 1972 Supreme Court case called Frontiero versus Richardson. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued for Frontiero and won that case, which is how husbands of military women became able to get health care.
Well, I mean, that is a world of information that I've heard pieces of along the way, but it shows our listeners really the scope of this conversation. And so I'm curious to hear from you with your work directly with SWAN. From the looks of your website, it's divided into three main buckets. There's Unify, there's Support, and there's Impact. So what angle of that whole conversation are you all focusing on right now? Which policy are we trying to peel back today?
Right now, the policy that we deal with, well, there's two, actually. The one we deal with on the what you can and can't do as a woman in the military is one where the policy have changed, but where the culture hasn't caught up with the change, which is women in ground combat units.
Wow.
Women in infantry, in artillery, in armor, tanks and things. We have had women in aboard Navy ships and aircraft, flying aircraft now since the early 90s, and that's because Congress repealed the provisions of that 1948 law after the Gulf War, which began to allow the Navy and the Air Force in particular and all the services with aircraft to begin to grow women up in those fields. But it is only in since two years since we have allowed women into things like Marine Corps and Army infantry, tanks and that kind of thing, special forces. And in addition to getting the women and finding the women who are interested in doing something like that and who are strong enough physically to do it, you've got to change the culture. So the women are welcomed when they try to do it, just as the men are.
And when
and
you
that's where we're stuck sometimes these days.
Right. When you say culture, are you speaking specifically about internally at the military, or are you speaking about the culture in various ROTC programs at universities or at large? What are
I'm talking about, I'm probably using the term in two different ways. One is the culture of the individual military service. And every service has its own culture. Being in the Navy culturally is not like being in the Marine Corps, say. And within that, occupations within it have their own subcultures. I'll talk about Navy. Navy surface ships and Navy pilots and Navy submariners have three different ways of looking at things, three different cultures. A lot based in what you need as a person, what qualities you need as a person to succeed. And as a nuclear submariner, you need brains more than brawn. As a fighter pilot, you probably need guts and courage. And part of what has come into the minds, particularly of the kinds of occupations that just have avoided women for the past 70 years, is that one of the personal qualifications is you got to be a male.
Sure.
And of course, that's not true, but we've got to, you can tell people that they're coming and they better behave, but you've also got to convert them internally. Or they're going to be very lousy officers or senior enlisted people, because women are going to be working for them, and they have to know how to be a good boss of women now as well as men. And that means things like knowing what women's haircut regulations are, knowing what to do if, God forbid, and it happens with men too, somebody cries when you scold them. It has to be how to have a professional working relationship with somebody of the opposite sex. And every time the military over the past 70 years has opened up new fields to women, all this stuff has to be gone through again with the new group of men and women trying to get used to each other and their families.
Sure. Are there any trainings that are starting to help with this transition? I assume there's a vast array of various HR versions happening.
Yes, there are. And a lot of them have been tried and gotten better over time, because as each, say, when we went through this with Navy ships back in the early 90s, we learned a lot about how to do it, not just for the women, but for the men in the crew, for the families of men, that the Army, say, or the Marine Corps now are using as they go through it. One of the things they learned is not to put in the Navy is not to put 60 brand new women at a boot camp on a ship all by themselves with no senior women around. And it's not to have the senior women can serve as role models, but the main thing is you need the senior women, and by that I mean the senior enlisted women, Navy would call them chiefs or the sergeants in the Army, to tell the women, to tell the men how to behave around the women, to teach them how to be the boss of women. And to let them know they can't get away with the kind of shit some of them have tried to get away with. Excuse my French there.
No, that's totally fine. Go for it.
As far as harassment or you don't belong in my Navy kind of stuff. So the senior women teach their peers And that has been very helpful, is to have, and also there are a lot of men of very good will out there, and they want to know. And this is somebody that they can go to learn how to teach them. So that's one of the things that we've learned in the military over the hard way, always the hard way. And we learned that you got to let the families say how they feel about it, the wives and the children sometimes, and the husbands of the women. And you got to let the men talk about what worries them about it, just to be vocal. And it's a way of just learning what they are afraid of so you can work with them on that. And that's what good leaders want to do.
And that really makes me think about an ongoing issue with the military, men and women, is mental health. It's an issue that is, I think we're paying more attention to it now, but obviously it's been going on for years. And then we have struggles with PTSD, especially with veterans coming back and the resources. So I want to talk a little bit about mental health for our female veterans in particular. I was reading a study that was saying that female veterans are more likely to die by suicide than women who did not serve in the military. And then, it's not even that recent. In 2011, a survey was taken, and it's the most recent one of its kind, saying that 46% of women veterans in California reported a current mental health problem. So, what are the resources that these women have right now, and what is the country doing at large to help these women?
Yeah. Now, one thing I would clarify on that California thing with the 46% women, mm-hmm. that's 40%, it was 46% of women who were in one particular VA hospital healthcare group.
Okay.
So it was a very limited sample. And because particularly at that time, it's changing now, most women veterans steered clear of the VA because there were so many men that they weren't even seen as sometimes as people that ought to be getting these kinds of benefits. They were usually considered somebody's wife. So that, but there are, the men's and the women's mental health needs are similar in a lot of ways, but women have this problem of also having to adjust to a male culture, which the men don't have. And it's an added stressor on them. They always have to prove when they first get to a place that they can hack it. For the men, it's usually, we'll assume you can hack it until you show us you can't. So men and women are in the same fishbowl in some ways, but swimming in different water in other ways, even when they're in the same spot. One of the problems at VA, and that is where a lot more women are getting health care since 9/11, is that they don't have enough space for inpatient healthcare for as many women as might need it. Some of the women who have mental health issues in the military, particularly those who have been sexually assaulted, which also happens to a lot of men, have comorbidities that have to be treated as well as the PTSD from the sexual assault. You may be dealing with alcohol abuse or drug abuse, something that they use to sort of bury the pain after it happened to them, particularly if retaliation was involved. And some of them are single mothers with children, and they don't want to lose custody of their children. And VA is not allowed to spend money on children. They're allowed to spend money on veterans, and there aren't any child veterans, thank God, yet. So there are complexities dealing with women with mental health care that usually exceed those that the men bring with them.
I'm curious, just to circle back a little bit, you touched on the VA not providing resources to women in its, you know, full capability earlier. And so that sounds like that's a recent shift in the narrative. You mentioned around 9/11. And so what sparked that change?
A couple of things. Congress began to get involved with this, the Congressional Veterans Affairs Committees, in the 90s after the Gulf War. And they set up, passed legislation which set up a center for women veterans at VA. And that group, with a special advisory committee that traveled the country, and I was lucky enough to be on that committee for 6 years, to talk to women veterans and see what they did or didn't need, why they would or wouldn't use VA. And they had every 2 years, a report went to Congress on the findings. And Congress began to change the law. And Congress began to monitor and hold hearings on these kinds of issues. And also, the media was involved, particularly when women deployed, 40,000 women deployed over to the theater of war for the Gulf War, which is the largest deployment of women we had had to date. There was a lot of media interest, and that sparked Congress to look, and the Department of Defense also, they to say, okay, you know, these women have been in a war zone. We want VA, when they finally get out, to begin to learn how to deal with them. A lot of academic institutions began to get funding from the military to do research women veterans. And there is a PSD up in Boston. VA has an institute that studies PTSD and other results of other kinds of mental and physical results of being in combat zones or combat. And they began to include women in their samples, and they began to oversample for women so they would have enough women in the study to make some statistical conclusions about it. So there was a lot going on in the 90s that had prepared VA. They also began to look at things like, if there's a woman amputee, we need to have prosthetics that a woman's body that fit a woman's body, and think about, you know, women often wear bare armed clothing, which men don't, say at a formal thing, or they might want to wear high heeled shoes. Can you wear those with a prosthetic leg? So they began to just look at a lot of these practical things in the 90s, and began to change VA quietly. After Iraq and Iran, I mean, Iraq and Afghanistan, we deployed almost 300,000 women at one time or another there. So these things that were sort of little somebody's little project before the war suddenly became big needs.
Sure.
And it takes time to get funding. It takes time to get training done on the staff and all of that. And we're finally beginning to see some breakthroughs there where they're able to just handle some of these things routinely. But it's taken 20 years.
Sure. Well, progress is progress. So that's exciting nonetheless, especially since it's in kind of a systemic way. The VA is a large organization that is slowly turning, and, you know, the military itself is providing trainings and slowly turning. And so I'm curious, I took a look at the SWAN strategic plan on the website, which is excellent for everybody who's listening to check out. And one of the goals in there is to, quote unquote, connect service women with SWAN peers and the broader community. And so I'm curious to hear from you, what do you believe is the broader community's role in supporting women in the armed forces?
I want to know that women are in the armed forces. It always astonishes me to hear people say, oh, we didn't know that. And not only that they're there, but they're not all nurses.
Right.
And that they are actually in combat these days. They have been in aboard combat ships and combat aircraft since the early 90s. And in the Iraq and Afghanistan operations, almost 900 women have been awarded Purple Hearts. And unfortunately, well over 100, close to 150 have been killed in action. And American people just don't know that. Mm. Some do, but it's not the average person on the street, if you ask them about that, wouldn't know it.
And I wonder why. Yeah, that's really upsetting. It only because, you know, we see all these war movies that come out. And I, unfortunately, and maybe this is my own ignorance, I can't think of the last war-themed movie that centralized around a female protagonist. That didn't keep...
There was one, and it's called Courage Under Fire, which is a Gulf War movie, and Meg Ryan played the lead.
Courage Under Fire.
It's about a woman who finds herself by happenstance in combat with male soldiers. She does things that sort of save the day, but some of the men in the unit can't stand it and lie about it. And it's about the investigation. I think Denzel Washington is the guy that does it in the movie.
I think
finds out to reconstruct what happened. That is the only one I can think of off the top of my head. There's a couple of other ones now, like Megan Levy, which is the one about the woman dog handler. So there are a few, but that one, it's you know, one of those movies you only see at the art theater in town.
Right, and I think I'm thinking G.I. Jane now too, again, like that was like 20 years ago. And,
oh, yeah,
you know,
1997, that one was.
Yes.
And that's something, you know, it's about a woman who's becoming, I think, a Navy SEAL. That is now open to women. It's a two-year training, so nobody has gone through it yet. And I'm not sure that anybody has even made the cut yet to even try. But, yeah, that's a movie. And the other one that always occurs to me is the, it's a space movie, Star Troopers.
Sure.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Starship Troopers, I think. Is that the name?
Yeah, Starship Troopers.
That one, yeah.
But that's, you know, science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But there, women are just part of the troops. I mean, they're doing everything and nobody thinks twice about it.
Which is, you know, that's how we want it to be.
Exactly. That's how it should be. Yeah.
Exactly.
we'll take that one. I'm curious. I was also digging around on your website. And it looks like you have an event coming up in Atlanta around coalition strategy development and getting multiple. It says, I think the press release said like 44 or more organizations getting together to really talk about how to build a web of support under the leadership of SWAN. So are you involved in that event at all? Can you give us a little info?
I am involved, the main workers on it are two of our other staff members. But when you're doing something like this, everybody's involved.
Sure.
And we did a survey 2 years ago of people at women veterans who came to the website. And we had several hundred participate, and we asked them what they would like to see that just wasn't available to them. And what a high number of them said is they wanted the opportunity to meet other women veterans in their local communities, wherever they live now, to help each other or to just socialize together, to compare notes, to tell their war stories, you know, like the guys at the VFW, not necessarily around the bar, but to have a group of women friends that would know what they were talking about when they started telling their war stories. And what we found is we began to look into what kind of social support in particular was out there for women. A lot of women veterans do belong to the big veteran service organizations like VFW or Iraq and Afghanistan veterans or Vietnam veterans. But those are mostly male membership, and what they can help you with a lot of things like how to file a disability claim or something. A lot of the women were looking for peer women to just hang out with.
Sure.
And there are a number, or to work on a particular problem in their community. And we found as we started looking around just on the web, just seeing what kind of veterans, women's groups were out there. There's no big all-woman veteran service organizations. But there are a lot of local groups, sometimes within a state, sometimes within a big city, sometimes just locally in a rural area. Women, sometimes they get together to work on problems to help homeless veterans.
Mm.
Or they get together once a month for a potluck dinner at somebody's house. And we began talking to them, and there are some local ones in the D.C. area where our headquarters are. And we wanted the cross-section of women veterans. We wanted to, you know, because the military women are much more both ethnically and racially diverse than the men. More than half of all enlisted women in the military come from minority groups, and so do a quarter of the women officers. So we wanted to get groups from different ethnicities, different races, different areas of service, different parts of the country, some who lived rurally, some who lived in big cities, to see if they had the same sort of need. And most of them said yes, and they wanted to know each other. So we're convening this in early September in Atlanta, and we're hoping it will take off.
Sure. I mean, I think it sounds like you've really identified a need. So I can only imagine that it's going to be incredibly successful in bringing people together.
Now we're trying to just raise money so that the women who don't happen to live in Atlanta, so some of those groups can afford to come, because most of these small local groups don't have any funding or grants or whatever. It's just local women, buying potluck dinner out of their own pockets. So we're trying to raise awareness and trying to raise some funding so that they can take a plane or a train or whatever to Atlanta and have a place to sleep and some food to eat while they're there, that they don't have to pay for themselves. So funding this is one of the hard things.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I feel that as someone who's worked in the nonprofit sector, it's ongoing, you know? So
it's ongoing. Exactly.
Speaking of that, so I'm curious. So for all of our listeners, you can find SWAN online at servicewomen.org, and there's a nice donate button in the top right.
There sure is.
But aside from that, you know, what are the other ways that our listeners can get involved in either in your organization and or in the conversation around women in combat at large?
Well, we also have Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and that kind of stuff. So you can sign up for those feeds. And when something is coming up that we think is helpful to women that might be before Congress, we might put out a call saying, hey, call your congressmen or your senators and tell them you support thus and such a veterans bill. We've done that with the Military Justice Improvement Act, which Senator Gillibrand has been pushing for a number of years now to try to halt military, not only the sexual assault, but the retribution that sometimes follows it when somebody reports it, by changing some of the procedures in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So if you follow us, you'll know when something you're interested in might be coming up for votes in Congress. And we try to put out papers sometimes with information on why something is important to women veterans. We do have some volunteers that do work for SWAN. And some of them live as far away as Alaska. Some of what we do is help other women veterans who call in. And some of the people that take those calls are people with some training who do it, from their home in Alaska or Philadelphia or things like that. That takes some special skill sets, but we're always looking for volunteers, particularly people who have good computer literacy, too. So, and we take interns in the summer, and we like for them to be veterans. It's not mandatory, but it's helpful if they're veterans. We also use them sometimes for local public affairs things. So there are a lot of different ways that you can get involved. Some of them don't involve too much time. Some of them might involve a lot of time. Donations are always welcome, and that's another way to be involved.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And every dollar counts, especially when you're pulling those travel budgets together. It's like, we just had like $122 more dollars. This additional person can come. So
yeah,
every single dollar.
If they have good ideas about something or a law that they'd like to see changed, we can teach them what the legislative process is, so they can work with their own members of Congress to try to get something changed in the law. And when you see somebody do that and have some success for the first time, it's a real kick for them and for us who are coaching them. It's really, really cool. One person can get a lot done if they sort of learn the process for doing it. And sometimes we can teach them how to do that.
And that's awesome that you guys do this. It's really wonderful, and I'm so glad that we were able to talk to you today. You know, as it says on the website, today there are nearly 2.5 million service women in the U.S., the highest number ever in history. Their voices deserve to be heard. And so, Lori, thank you so much for being a part of that and making sure that these women's voices are heard on the larger scale.
Well, thank you for doing this, because you're helping us get the word out. So thank you.
No problem. And we'll hope to be there and continue the good fight with you.
All right. For this episode's Spotlight series, we have a friend of the pod from last season, Kelsey Rhodes, who's a voice associate at Physicians for Reproductive Health.
Physicians for Reproductive Health unites the medical community with concerned supporters, and together we work to improve access to comprehensive reproductive health care, including abortion and contraception. Through advocating for basic bodily autonomy on the state and federal policy levels, as well as in local and national media outlets, we aim to shed light on why comprehensive reproductive health care should be accessible no matter your gender, sexuality, race, socioeconomic status, or religion. You can learn more about our work, our programs, and ways to get involved by visiting us at www.prh.org or on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at PRHDocs. It's really hard to narrow it down to just one thing, but in the past 25 years, Physicians for Reproductive Health has been making strides in expanding access to reproductive health care. And one of the ways that we do that, and one of the things we're most proud of, is that we've formally trained over 320 physicians in 43 states on how to be advocates for comprehensive, compassionate reproductive health care. And I'm one of the people who have gone through those trainings. Through programs like our Leadership Training Academy, our fellows learn how to be fearless and how to use their voice both in the media and in policy. We've spoken out in the print and online media, on the radio, on television, and we've also testified before Congress, before state legislatures, and other places when our patients' rights are at stake. There has never been a better time to use your voice to support basic human rights like access to reproductive health care. Here are three ways that you can get involved with Physicians for Reproductive Health right now. First, try to stay in the know. I know it feels like drinking from a fire hose. I know that the news is often not good, but we are always looking for folks to subscribe to our advocacy alert emails through our website. This will help keep you up to date on direct actions that you can take to protect access to basic healthcare. You can join the newsletter on the very bottom of the website at prh.org. Secondly, consider sharing your story. You can share why access to healthcare matters to you or to someone that you love by submitting your Voices of Courage story at prh.org/voices-of-courage. You can explore the over 550 stories from people just like you around the country and add your voice through the online submission form, which is really easy to use. This is a way that you can use your voice to contribute to collective power. Thirdly, consider supporting our cause. Access to reproductive health care is under threat now more than ever, and we need your help. You can help sustain our programs and our physician advocates by becoming a donor. You can learn more about how we use your donations at prh.org/donate. And if you can't give money, which we very much understand, then consider amplifying our message by retweeting, sharing our Facebook posts, talking to your friends and family, and having some of those hard conversations with the people you love, because people's health and people's lives depend on it. No matter how you support Physicians for Reproductive Health, know that we will keep fighting for you and for all of our access to safe, legal health care.
And that's it for this week's episode of We Rebel podcast. As always, please feel free to contact us if you have any questions for the two of us or our guests at werebelpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on all the social medias at We Rebel Podcast, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
See everybody next week.
Rachel, Oscar.
Yeah, Claire?
Do you love Disney movies?
Uh-huh.
Have you seen them all? Not all of them.
What do you guys think if we watch them all in chronological order and then talk about them?
Ooh. Oh, and what if we could talk about it with some of our favorite friends?
I love that.
Yeah, what if we do it inside the Disney Vault?
You know, that's the name of our podcast, Inside the Disney Vault on Campfire Media.
Yeah, check us out on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to yours.
That's Inside the Disney Vault.
Let's go. Woo!
Campfire.